The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, here we go. The second migration was out of the ghettos by members of the working and middle class. Okay, now what happens now? What happens? Round about 1965, okay, to 70, what happens in the ghetto? Well, all right, let me give you some anthropological stuff here. All right. When the population of a community between 5 and 19 approaches 40%. When this population between these ages gets to 40% in the community, that's critical mass for the formation of gangs. That's when you begin to have the gang formation, all right? So that's what happened in the ghetto. The gangs started forming, started terrorizing the community. The second great thing that happened, and I'll probably say this on the slideshow, so just bear with me. I just get caught up. I like to close my notes sometimes and preach. All right. The second thing happened was the easing of housing discrimination. All right. So now you have a push and a pull force. Okay. All right. Now here it is. There it is. It was facilitated by the end of housing discrimination as a result of the civil rights movement. And as I said, the gang warfare. So the gangs start forming, and the community starts getting terrorized. And now all of a sudden, I don't have to live here anymore. So those who could get out did get out. So most of the leaders and institutions, with their strong positive influence, flew the coop. They left. You can understand why they did. I mean, you know.
What sort of institutions? Churches?
Well, not so much churches, but boys' clubs or just clubs, informal kind of institutions, basically, you know. Because the churches tended to stay, though they became commuter churches. All right? All right. All right. All right. So by the early 70s, what do we have? The urban heavy industry was also gone. Because you remember, by the time you get to the 70s, what's happening? The smokestack industries in the north are moving to the south because there's right-to-work states and stuff like that, right? Right? And they're moving overseas, right? Okay. The working population had left the ghettos. Just left. As I said, those who could get out did get out. Now, let me explain something to you. Now, remember I said there were some who were in situations where the father was absent? When they went up north, they didn't have the values, the achievement values, okay? And those where the father was present, they came up here with the achievement values. And those people succeeded, relatively speaking, and those people, these other people didn't. So the people who succeeded are the ones who could get out. So once that happened, I mean, you had folks getting out of there like crazy, all right? Even into the suburbs, all right? All right. Question.
You said urban heavy industry went south.
Yeah, the steel mills and okay. Here's another.
Did they also go like horizontal for the suburbs? I mean,
they did, and they also the microprocessor chip replaced labor. In Gary, Indiana, you had these steel mills along here, right? U.S. Steel. Now, the U.S. Steel used to, when I left Gary, U.S. Steel employed 25,000 people. When I went back, and Gary had a population of 210,000. When I went back to Gary 2 years ago, U.S. Steel was employing 800, producing more steel than ever, and the population of the city was 115,000. There it is. Stark illustration of what's happening. Gary's a dead city. All right. So the working population was gone. The heavy industry was gone. The underclass, the people who couldn't get out, the people who didn't have the achiever values, were stuck there. They were cut off. They were just totally cut off from the rest of society. All right? And the only influential leaders and institutions left in the ghettos were the criminal ones. So now when Willie gets up, he sees Junebug over here with his orange suit and his souped up Mercedes, and he knows, you know, and Junebug's, he's a CEO of a multinational corporation. Only problem is he's just selling a bad product. Okay? All right, so now that's his model of influence. All right? All right. All right. So, what happens? What followed the second migration was a free fall into social disorganization in the ghetto. And the thing about it, you know, if you would go to the ghettos around 1975, the one thing that you would notice, they were empty. You know, you think of the ghettos being overcrowded and everything, but you go there, it's empty. Hardly anybody's around. Okay? All right? Unemployment soared. Welfare dependency proliferated. All right? Because now we're talking about people without the values, right? Without the achiever values. The new values are developing, okay? There was a serious breakdown in the family, obviously. And there was an explosion of out of wedlock birth rate. Now that goes along with that happens in the wake of all these poverty, this great society stuff. Because suddenly they made it the great society, it was well intentioned. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, but I mean the great society made some assumptions. My father actually ran the anti-poverty program in Gary, and he resigned after a year in frustration. He said, "This thing is ridiculous. This is creating more poverty than it is helping." You know, it was ridiculous. So he and the problem with the Great Society programs is that the people who put the programs together presumed that the people in the ghetto had the same value system that they did. But by this time, you have a new value system coming along. And so, you know, it's kind of like, you know, aspirin's a wonderful drug, but some people are allergic to it. You know what I'm saying, all right? All right, so out of wedlock birth proliferated. Now we got, you know, clinics handing out birth control pills and saying, well, it's okay, do what you feel, and so forth and so on, you know, because we're having this. Okay, all right. All right. As I said, the ghettos are empty. They lost considerable. That's it. I got ahead of myself. You know, you go there and they're empty, right? Okay. Yet, though the ghettos are empty, or though the ghettos had become empty, the manifestations of chaos and disorganization had risen, like crime, like out of wedlock births. Now, what's going on now? You say, okay, you might say that, you know, the conservatives will come along and say, well, see, the problem is welfare. See, if we get rid of welfare, see, because it's the welfare that's causing these girls to go out and have babies. Because you see, after all, you know, they can make some money if they can just get pregnant, get their own apartment. You know, they're living with auntie, who's giving them all kind of headaches, right? And they want to get away from auntie, so the government says, have a baby. We'll give you your own apartment, a steady income, and health care. And so they do this. Now that's a conservative theory, which I think is, it's I have two words for it. okay, but I can understand that. You know, that's along the same lines that right. That's along the same lines that trailer parks cause tornadoes. You know, okay, you got me. All right, I don't think that's really it. Now the liberals come along and say, well, see, now, here's the solution. You can heal the ghettos not by getting rid of welfare, but bringing jobs. You know, you hear that one too, right? Yeah. Well, okay. I have the same analysis of that. Too. Yeah. Now, having said all of that, let me say this. Yes, the welfare system is a contributing factor. And yes, the lack of jobs are a contributing factor. But I don't think that's really the bedrock of it now. And why did they miss it? Why did the conservatives and liberals miss what the bedrock was? Because they did not have a biblically based view, and therefore it was inadequate. That's just like the leaders of the 60s. They had an analysis of racism, but it wasn't radical enough. All right. Well, I'm bringing this up because I'm trying to show you something here that that we have a that we have an opportunity here, a challenge and an opportunity. So the overarching reason for the explosion of black illegitimacy, Ray, was not the welfare system or unemployment. Okay, as I said, these are factors. Okay, why do I know this? Because during the Depression period, almost a half of all black families were dependent on the government. And guess what? The out of wedlock birth rate didn't climb. Matter of fact, it was much lower among blacks than it was among whites for many, many years. You know, fact is that most out of wedlock. The fact is, like during the 60s, 60% of all children born out of wedlock were African American. This is during the mid 60s. 60% of all out-of-wedlock births were African-American, but 95% of all illegal abortions were white. So now when you factor all that in, the white rate of out-of-wedlock pregnancies was higher. Isn't that interesting? Okay. Okay. So during the 30s, half of the black families were on welfare of some kind, but there was no increase. So it's not welfare that caused the problem. And that's why the conservatives, I don't know why they didn't do their history, you know. All right? The conservatives don't, and the liberals don't have a handle on this either, by the way. All right? All right. All right. Now, watch this. Since the Reagan years, the welfare rose has shrunk, but yet the illegitimacy rate has gone up. So we're looking at, and we're looking at the underclass situation. What's going on here? What is going on? Can anybody guess? All right. Hey, before the welfare program came, you know, you had this phenomenon was there. So again, it wasn't what generated it. Okay. All right. This aspect of life in the ghettos, which people have most control over, they had no control over the welfare system or anything. Okay, this is it's the last thing to change. I mean, this is something else is going on here, and these other factors are contributing. Okay, all right. So you got all this misery in the ghetto. You got all this going on. So why are you having all this destructive behavior? Why all this problem? Well, let's look at the Moynihan Report, okay? Black unemployment rates had been double the white rates continuously since the early 30s, but the out-of-wedlock thing took off during the 50s. Now, why? Again, was it the issue of jobs? No, I don't think it was the issue of jobs. Yes, it was a contributing factor, yes, but it wasn't the actual issue. That wasn't the cause of the underclass, okay? Here it is. The primary reason why so many unmarried teenagers have children in the ghetto is cultural. All right? Now, when we're talking about a cultural phenomenon, then we're talking about a set of values. All right? All right? Now, what does the gospel do? It changes your values. What does reform theology do? It is a comprehensive theological system that addresses all areas of life. At least that's what it's supposed to do, right? All right, it is a cultural situation, okay? It has become a custom, all right? It has become a way of life. I remember I lived in Carver Court's apartments when I was going to Hampton. And it was one of these, it was the hood, in the middle of a hood, right? And, I was a student, I was 20, and these girls would come by, 11 years old, and say, hey, I want you to do me a favor. I couldn't understand it then, All right, I'll just run through this. These pregnancies are not accidental. Their friends are having babies, the boyfriends pressured them into it. It's a status symbol. It became a status symbol, okay? All right. That's what's going on. So I'm trying to help you to understand the nature of this of this culture, why these core issues came up, okay? All right. So welfare does provide a financial underpinning, but the rate these girls do not go out to have babies to get on welfare. All right. So summary. What are we looking at? Okay. So here it is. Two main factors which led to the emergence of the underclass. All right. Here we go. Rapid urbanization. All right. The isolation of the black lower class in the cities. The result was the underclass flourished during the 70s when it was completely disengaged from society. Now let's connect another dot. In the 60s, remember I said that we changed from being a primarily assimilational people to a primarily identificational people? Remember that? Now let's connect the dot here. Just as African Americans were discovering, oh, wait a minute, our culture is just as valid as anybody else's. We're just as American as anybody else's in all of our non-whiteness. So, I'm black and I'm proud, right? 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 Just as that started happening, and we said, hey, a lot of these people, we're trying to get Willie to do right because the object was assimilation. So, therefore, instead of understanding that there were achievement values under that, they said, okay, well, we're going to stop telling Willie about this. We're going to shut up. If he wants to, blow some smoke, that's fine. That's because that's his thing. And so just as we started saying, don't criticize my cultural values because they're okay, that's just when you had the beginning of the development of this underclass culture. All right. So the underclass culture. So what happened? The underclass culture developed, with a set of values with no brakes on it. You got me? So just as when we got into this, I'm okay kind of thing, and we stopped making any value judgments about values, cultures, or anything else like that, because we had tossed out everything, there are no absolutes. It was just then when the poverty culture began to develop. And we didn't recognize it until it was too late. Then all of a sudden, everybody starts talking about good and evil. All right? You got it? All right. Got it? And so that's what happens. And as a result of this culture forming, it's become a culture now with a set of values. And out of that comes some core issues, pain, rage, remasculation. You ever wonder why the rappers denigrate women? I mean, you put them down, call them the B word and all that kind of stuff. It's not because they're necessarily trying to denigrate women. They're trying to figure out this manhood piece, but they don't have access to true manhood, and so therefore they substitute machismo for manhood. Got it? Now that's the world in which we need to communicate the gospel. All right. So that was the development of the development. I just thought I'd share that with you. So I want you to know that when I make such statements about this, there's a whole lot of stuff that goes to it. Okay? Yes. Right.
Was he addressing the other half of this issue? Did he have his finger on the other half of this core?
I'm not sure. I don't think so, because you see, this poverty culture had not really formed yet. It was still in transition, and I don't think we figured that out in those days. He was talking about economics. I don't think he was talking about a cultural issue. Okay. I don't think so.
The second question is, oftentimes, conservative evangelicals mentioned, it's very difficult to be Christian if you're not Republican because you, you know, how can you vote for somebody who's going to commit abortions? And then, oftentimes in the traditional church, it's vice versa. It's difficult to be Christian if you're not a Democrat because you don't care about people. And
exactly.
A lot of the cultural phenomenon you see, like, because of the subdominant culture, the black culture, having a higher value of life, and in the sense of
Abortion, as I said, it was never a big issue among us because, you see, you know, we didn't kill our babies. We just sent them down to, you know, like, you know, Aunt so-and-so would raise the kid, you know, and we did adoptions within the family. You know, this abortion on demand business, that was something that was imposed on, you know, on the ghettos. And of course, and I don't know if you know this, but if you know, have you ever heard of the name Margaret Sanger? Okay, you know what she was about, right? She wanted to eliminate all non-white people, especially black folks. She was a Nazi. I mean, she was a forerunner of a proto-Nazi. Let's put it that way. She's the one that started family planning, and the whole purpose was to eliminate. That's right, Planned Parenthood. She started it. Now, I'm not saying that people who work for Planned Parenthood are of that philosophy, but I'm just saying that that's what. And you know what is what's interesting? If you go back to the 60s, and this is just some, these are just things that are going on, swirling around the community, and the church has still got its head buried in the sand talking about I meet my, right? Back in the 60s, the Black Panther Party, the Black Unity Congress, SNCC, COFO, and all these other radical black power, Ungawa kind of movements, they were all staunchly pro-life. Hello, and they saw the family planning clinics in the neighborhood as genocide. Now, how do we go from that to this? You know, to a, well, anyway, I don't know. So what's going on here? I don't know. What's happening is I think a lot of there is an agenda that's being carried out by some radicals of a certain ilk, and they are using poor women. They're hiding behind them saying, yeah, these poor people can't get... But see, it was never an issue with us because, again, you know, it was an adoption. There were adopters within the family all the time. But this phenomenon of this abortion on demand and all that kind of stuff, that's come up in the last 10, 20 years. That hasn't been a...
The very thing that is the issue the most for conservative evangelical Christians is something that, on the whole, the African-American community has a handle on because they have a...
Yeah, we didn't. We never really had much of a problem with it until like the last 20 years, when all this stuff was just put in place, and all this. You do your own thing, do what you want to do, and here's some pills, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, let's look at some achiever values and middle class values. Okay, achiever values of the middle class, survival values of the underclass. All right, here we go. This is just a short list of some of the contrasting values. Okay, middle class people put a high value on ambition. Guess what? In the underclass, hard work yields getting ahead. That's what middle class people say. That's the value of the middle class. Okay, ambition. Hard work yields getting ahead. Now let's look at the corresponding value in the underclass. Resignation. Why? Because hard work does not yield getting ahead. You work all you want to, you're not going to get ahead. So, you know. Now, you ever wonder why immigrants do so well? See, they come here and they have those values intact. See? All right. That's why. All right. Let's look at another one. Delayed gratification is a value for middle class folk, okay? All right. Guess what? You know, so why? Because tomorrow will be better than today. So I'm going to go to school now. I'm going to get my degree, right? Because I'm going to do better tomorrow. Because tomorrow will be better than today. Watch this. Instant gratification for the underclass. Why? Because tomorrow will not be better than today. You know. You get paid. And now you got to figure out how you're going to blow this money. Right? The eagle flies on Friday. What? Saturday, I go out to play. Sunday, I go to church and I kneel down and pray. Okay. Okay, all right. Ready for this? You see, there's a different set of values here. All right, we got to understand that. Now, how do we address these things as Bible believing people? Okay, preservation of property is a high value among middle class folks. All right, guess what? Exploitation of property. In the underclass, I mean, there's no sense of ownership. Why, you know, who cares? I mean, the screen, lean on the screen all you want to, it bulges out, it breaks out. Well, you know, it's not mine anyway. You know, sense of ownership is gone. No control. What the heck? All right. Middle class. Time orientation. Okay, in other words, it involves planning. Middle class people plan, right? Guess what? Underclass, survivor value. Crisis orientation, you know? Huh, no planning. I know the phone bill is due. All of a sudden, I got no phones. Oh, I gotta do something about it. Now, a lot of people go into urban ministry, you know, and they want to do all this. And they say, oh, well, we'll help you pay your phone bill, but they don't impact the value system, you see? Okay, all right. You remember Sanford and Son? There was this one scene where he posted, okay, the power company, it throws that in the trash. Bell Telephone throws that in the trash. You're looking for some mail, you know. He didn't care. Well, okay. Okay. I think there's one more here. Okay. Middle class put a value, a high value on goal orientation, right? Goal orientation. You know, again, that involves planning again, you know. I'm out to do something, right? Of course, the underclass is need orientation. Okay? No planning again. Just need. I just do whatever I... You know, and so you don't think in terms of well, you know, do I go to bed with this kid? You know, this dude. You know, I know I might get pregnant. You know, have a kid for the rest of my life. But I don't think about that. I'm thinking about, you know, right now. Value systems. Okay, all right. So now, all right, you got it. So now it is out of that set of values that comes the nihilistic culture. See, the nihilistic culture of poverty, and out of that then comes. The dysfunctionality core issues, which then has resonated with people all across the country, you know. So what's going on? I think what's happening here is as we're seeing a general meltdown of the American the whole American society, and that even rich kids are feeling these very same issues. Okay. All right. So finally, I'll close with this. So what we've got here, then, you know, as we look at the history of the African American Church today, are the what I call the disconnected generations. The disconnected generations. All right. The Black Church and its theology was largely rejected during the days of the Black Consciousness Movement. Why? Because the church did not address the issues. And it was seen as being irrelevant. And it was seen as an attempt to pacify. That's why they said Christianity is a white man's religion. I mean, after all, people had religion and they didn't get anywhere. All right? Baby boomers, Gen Xers, millennium generations have largely been orphaned by the traditional church. That's why some of us are here at this very seminary right now, I think. Some of us right here are orphans, okay? So as a result, our generations are becoming historically and culturally disconnected. And these three, especially the last two of those generations, are the first truly unchurched generations in the history of the African American community. All right? Now, if we're going to challenge, if we're going to be challenged by the gospel, then we are going to need to address what? The empowerment issues and the what? The dysfunctionality issues. All right? Okay. Now, let's look at something here, and I'll show you. Let's look at the African-American church and its cultural involvement in 1900 and look at the African-American church and its cultural involvement today. Okay, if I could find this here. Oh, yeah. I remember what that's called. It's called the church box. That's right. Okay, here we go. Here we go. Sometimes I've created over 300 of these things, and I forget what the names are sometimes, you know. Okay, now, watch this. Here we go. And this illustrates it, I think, the best way. Okay. In 1900, let's look at the cultural involvement of the African-American community and the theological reach of the African-American church. 1900. Okay, remember. This is what's happened by 1900. The theological vacuum is in place, but the momentum of the church is still carrying on. You know what I'm saying? All right. So let's look at it. Here we go. Let's imagine that that box represents all the possible things that one can be in the American culture. You can be a butcher, baker, candlestick maker, whatever. You know, as I said, my dad was a Tuskegee Airman, and he, I don't know if you know their history, but they amassed a very impressive, outstanding record in World War II. They escorted the bombers. Who went over, and they never lost the bomber to enemy fighters. They were the only group that could claim that. So much so that the bomber crews would rejoice when they found that they were going to be escorted by the Red Tails. All right, you know, Tuskegee Airmen. My dad got back from the war, and went back to Tuskegee to become a flight instructor for. Pilots flying B-25s, and most of the guys he trained how to fly were white. Now my dad wanted to be an airline pilot, but it was a career that was closed to African Americans. But a lot of those guys he taught how to fly have, for the last 20 years, have been retiring as 747 transoceanic pilots from the major airlines. Okay? All right. So, there were some things closed. So now in 1900, here's where the African-American community was restricted. There were only certain things we can do. You can be a hairdresser, you can be a doctor, you can be a teacher, you can be a lawyer, but you can't be a CEO. You can't be an executive. You can't be an airline pilot. You can't be an engineer. My mechanical drawing teacher in high school was a PhD in engineering, and he could not find a job in engineering, so he ended up having to be a mechanical drawing teacher. All right. So in 1900, what we had in the African American context was African Americans were restricted in their cultural involvement. There were only certain things we could do. But in those days, the African American church reached theologically everybody in the community. There was no one in the African American community who wasn't theologically reached by the African American church. Now, and so the church dealt with certain issues, personal issues, let me say. Whatever the issues were, but everybody was being ministered to, at least on the personal. Now on the cultural level, that had already gone. You know what I'm saying? Okay. Now that's 1900. But now let's look at today. What has happened today? What difference do we see today? Okay. So here we go. The cultural involvement of the African American community and the theological reach of the African American church today. Here we go. I'm insulted. Okay. Now there we were in 1900, right? Now what's happened since then? As a result of the civil rights movement and the black consciousness movement, there has been a great expansion of African Americans participating in the culture. Now my dad could be an airline pilot. Now, Mr. Beckwith could be an engineer. You got me? All, you know. Now, we can come to Westminster Seminary. Now, I hope y'all don't. I'd like to do some historical research on that to see if there were any attempts. Like Martin Luther King applied to a couple of evangelical seminaries and his application wasn't even accepted, so he goes to the liberal seminary and then we criticize him for being liberal. All right. Now that's where we are now. We have expanded. Now we haven't gotten to every place, you know. But we, you know, it's been a great deal of expansion. Things are much better. But where is the church? How far is the theological reach of the church? Got it? So what have we seen now? Now, we have seen upward mobility of African Americans, and we've seen lateral mobility. Now, we just got to talk about the lateral mobility. People are poor here, they're poor over here, but now they're disconnected from the church. That's what happened to the underclass situation. The value system's changed. So now you got this vast, these issues, these concerns, these people living beyond the theological reach of the church. And so what's popped up in that area? Well, there it is. Secularism, Nation of Islam, Mainline Islam, New Age, materialism. See? All right, and that's where we are today. So now, what's the challenge? Can we come back to Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church with the Reverend C.L. Jones as pastor and get Aunt Jane? Y'all know who Aunt Jane is, right? She's the mother of the church. To get her to come out to the mosque and talk to Junebug Muhammad? She ain't gonna do that. She can't do that, right? All right. Aunt Jane, I love Aunt Jane. She's great, but she's, you know, she ain't gonna do that. All right, so what do we do? Well, it calls for the formation of new types of churches. We need some additional models of the church. Now, when I say the church here, how many different kinds of churches are we talking about? We're talking about your Baptist churches. You're talking about your Methodist, Pentecostal, Holiness. There's several different kind of church models up in there, right? But I'm gonna tell you something. The existing models of the church are inadequate for the task. They can't do it. Oh, you can stretch them a little bit, you know. But you can't. This is old wineskins. Okay? The old wine and old wineskins, it's good wine now. Don't get me wrong. But it's old wineskins. So what we have to do is we have to develop new models of the church, some of which will have the flavor of the traditional church, very much so. Some will be radically different. Some will be, some will not be all African American. Some will be cross-cultural. Some will be virtually white churches, but have concerns, you know. We talk about new models of the church, and that's where we are. Now, if we're going to see the history of the church, if we're going to be able to have a course on the history of the African-American church in the year 2050, then that's what's going to have to happen. Because I think by 2050, we're going to see, you know what I'm saying? Oh, yeah, church will still be around, but you know, it's going to diminish, you know, because everything else will be, you know. And I think that's where we stand right now. That's the challenge that's before us. That we need to create new models of the church. So that's my little thing on the church box. And we've learned all these things up to this point. We've learned the different paradigms of so forth and so on. And we have to go back and look at our history and look at how our brothers did the stuff in the 19th century. And we need to do it not the way they did it in the 19th century, but we need to do it according to the 21st century, which means whatever theological institutions catch this vision and begin to do some primary spade work, which is what is needed, because this curriculum doesn't exist for this yet, you know. But this is the future. And I'd say, now let's take that and apply that to other groups. You know, Latinos of the different stripes, Asians, whatever, you know. You know, like, okay, you know, I understand white worship, and I was asking a brother from, I was asking a Chinese brother the other day, I said, I understand African-American worship, I understand white worship, help me, I don't know much about Asian worship, I can't figure it out. And he sat down and told me, I said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. He gave me the, it opened up for me. It's an incredible a thing. I had never thought of that before, you know. And that's something that if I was a pastor, I would incorporate. It's kind of a very contemplative kind of a thing, you know. It's excellent. Oh, very good, very good. But if whoever catches that vision, I think what's necessary, I think, to catch this is to understand then what Reformed theology would look like in a postmodern context. Okay, you know, modernism. There's some problems with modernism, aren't there? You know, it's not all right. You know, but we can do theology in that context and critique the things where it has gone wrong. So in the postmodern world, it's the same thing. You know, there's some things in the postmodern world that aren't right. But let me tell you this, some about the postmodern world. I mean, when I used to go on the campuses back in the 60s, the big issue was, does God exist? You know? And now I go onto the campus, that's not even an issue. Everybody knows God exists. That's not the issue. It's what kind of spirituality do you have? Well, I mean, you know, at least we can talk about some of that. You know, I don't have to go through the the ontological argument. You know, we learned all those things. The God is the greatest thing that can be conceived. You know, we don't have to go through all that crazy stuff. You know, but it's a whole different set of issues. And so I'm just suggesting here that I think that is where we need to do. Now, finally, let me kind of lay something else out there. If our history can teach us anything, Jesus tells us to go into all the world and make converts, right? Disciples, right? All right, now that's good. Now, I think it's going to require a whole new. It's going to require a whole new approach to discipleship. Now, for example, what we tend to look at, I'll do it on the side. What we tend to look at in discipleship is this. This is how we tend to see it. We say that a person comes along, and where does discipleship begin? Okay. Huh?
When you first meet them.
Okay, well, that's good. I think you've heard me on this one before. But most people would say, who are not enlightened, you know. Yeah, right. Who have not sat at my feet before? Okay. Right. At conversion, right there. Right. And then we start talking about discipleship. That's the old model. I don't think that's biblical. Because if that's the case, then Jesus couldn't start discipling the disciples until after the day of Pentecost. Or at least, if you want to look at it another way, until after he breathed on them. Oh, you want to be my disciple? Okay, come on. You know, come on. I don't think so. So discipleship starts when you first meet them, wherever they may be. All right? All right, that's when it starts. Now, check this out. I'm not an artist. Sorry about that. But that's the approach I take when I deal with Muslims. That's the approach I take when I deal with nationalists or whoever else. Wherever they may be on the window, I don't care. I start right there. And so there's this, what I call this pre-conversion discipleship concept. And we're missing that. Now, the reason that we're missing that is because in times past, I know when I studied under Schaefer, he used to talk about the Christian consensus. You ever hear that term? 100 years ago, there was a Christian consensus. That is, if you ask the average man in the street what the gospel is, they could tell you. Now you ask the average man in the street, he can't tell you. There is not the Christian consensus, okay? And we've lost that. Well, okay, fine. By the way, Can we talk about that in a minute? You know, a lot of people lament the passing of the Christian consensus, but and they decry the fact that we are in the secular humanistic era, right? Now let me look at it strictly from an African American point of view. Good riddance to the Christian consensus, because it was in those days I had to live in the ghetto, I had to ride in the back of the bus. I can't be an airline pilot. You understand what I'm saying? Now, you know, we're talking about association. I'm not saying that the Christian consensus caused that. But what am I saying? I'm saying that when we had the Christian consensus, we were poor stewards of it. Right? All right. Well, that's a little something to think about. All right. So we talk about this discipleship piece. And we talk about new models of the church. That's what I'm getting at. We've got to have something that does this, that takes people from where they are and disciples them. And what happens then, conversion then becomes one of those lessons you learn in the discipleship process. It's just like when you learn how to fly. Everybody thinks that when you do your first solo flight, you become a pilot. No, 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 no. The solo flight is just one of the steps on the way to becoming a pilot. See, because once you do your solo flight, in other words, you know how the mechanics of flying the airplane. Now you got to learn about navigation, and you got to do that's something that an instructor pilot can't help you with. You got to figure that out, you know. So, all right. So discipleship, we've got to rediscover this. Okay. Now, let me look at the Muslims again. The Muslims do this. The Muslims do this stuff all the time. Because they don't really have a strong sense of conversion like we do, you know. Oh, get Jesus into my pump. You know, I mean, they don't quite do it the way we do. I mean, you know, they'll make the confession and all that. But it's an ongoing teaching thing. And when we talk about discipling people up to this, we're talking about, come on now, come on. What are we talking about? What are we talking about addressing? The core issues. That's simple. That's simple. That's a simple thing. When you approach someone and we have to have institutions that do this as well as individuals, you know, there need to be, I don't know, pre-churches. Yeah, evangelical pre-churches. There you go. You know, I don't know what you call this, but when I talk about new models, that's what I'm talking about. Because you see, what happened, the reason that we start discipleship here is because back in the days of the Christian consensus, the culture did this. The culture doesn't do that anymore. All right. And so for a person to become a Christian, they got to make this giant leap because there's nothing there to hear. And once they get here, this thing is still moving back, right? The culture is still moving away from the gospel, right? So by the time they get here and get themselves saved, they make that same leap, and they're going to fall into the water because the thing is back further. So we've got to begin to link that together. And it seems to me that the greatest challenge we face right now is to rediscover what discipleship is. Now, you know, you deal with somebody, you deal with a group of people, they're going to reveal their superficial issues first. They're not going to deal with their core. You know, nobody in his right mind will come to you and tell you about his core issues straight up. You know what I'm saying? You know, hey, man, you know. No, they're going to reveal superficial stuff. So they reveal superficial. Let them do it. Apply the Word of God to that. And then they reveal something a little deeper, you know. Apply the Word of God to that, you know. And eventually it comes down to the point, hey, you know what's really bothering me? You know, remember the woman at the well? After all that talk about denominationalism and you know, racism and all that, you know, she finally comes down to the bedrock. She says, okay, here we go. Now she knew males, you know. By the way, I don't think she had a problem. I think it was those lousy guys she was married to, okay? I think that was her problem. I mean, you know, I'm not going to call her a lowlife. I like her, matter of fact. Anyway, she says, look, yeah, you know. She says, hey, you know, okay, well, let's just cut to the chase here, all right? I perceive now, and I'm throwing this thing. You know, she tried to compliment him. Oh, you're a prophet, and says, but he stuck with it, right? And she said, okay, fine. Here's the deal. My ultimate core issue is I'm looking for this Messiah guy to get it straight, and then you know the rest of it, you know. But she didn't reveal that to him at first. Maybe she didn't even want to deal with him, you know what I mean? And I'm saying that that's how we, you know. And we're patient. We let people ask the questions, and we let people dialogue. We don't just preach. You know, I'm going to tell you something. Preaching is probably the most inefficient means of communication there is out there today. And I like preaching now, you know. I love it. I love good preaching. But when I was a pastor, I did a little experiment. A couple of times, I preached a sermon, and 1 month later, I preached the exact same sermon, different title, exact same sermon, and nobody picked it up. Nobody picked it up. What is that? You know. So I'm thinking maybe we need to be more creative. I mean, maybe you know, in the. And I say the African American context is one of the most ripe, opportune contexts in which we can do it. If the hip hop culture has resonated with so many across the board in this country, then perhaps a theology coming out of the African American context, dealing with the issues like hip hop deals, might have the same effect. All right. So that's my little piece on that, and I think I'm gonna close. Yes.
If we're gonna start doing some of these new and different things, what sort of old things are we doing now that are gonna go out?
Well, we may not.
They're very busy. They're doing a lot of stuff. Well, what are they wasting their time doing now?
Don't get me started on that.
Why do
we have church at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning? Can anybody tell me? A rural setting set that time. Why? Because it was the ideal time between the morning and afternoon milkings of the cow. That's why we have church at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. What's the purpose of Sunday school? I don't see anything about Sunday school in the Bible. What precipitated the development of Sunday school? Industrial Revolution has something to do with that, right? Come on. Exactly. It was an urban reading program. Teach urban kids how to read. See? All right. Now let's just take those two things right there. Take those two things. The church is wasting its time perpetuating those traditions. Okay. Why do churches have pipe organs? Bach. Okay. All right. And he wrote wonderful pieces. Okay.
But
didn't they have harpsichords in those days? Why pipe organs? Catholic Church?
So the B3 can come along.
That's good. That's it. Now I perceive you have a vision. Okay. All right. Why pipe organs? Because the pipe organ was the cutting edge, state of the art of music synthesizer technology. That's what it was. It was a state of the art, cutting edge music synthesizer technology. It was a music. That's why. And they wanted the best for God, and they had the pipe organ, and it was the greatest. But now, of course, people say, well, I can't have worship without a pipe organ. You know, again, that's the kind of stuff we waste our time with. We need to analyze what we do. And having analyzed those things, we will discover that these are innovations based on cultural realities. So in the spirit of innovation, then let's look at today's culture and then see, maybe we should have church on Saturday night. I don't see anything where the Bible doesn't prescribe, I don't have anything against Sunday. I'm just saying that maybe we ought to have, You know, I look in the Bible and I don't see a whole lot of, you know, the call to worship and then the opening prayer and the prayer of consecration. I don't see any of that stuff in there. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong, you know. You know, and I look at the Bible and I look at church history. Okay, the Catholic Church went the sacramental route, you know, became sacrament-centered. Okay, then the Reformation came along and said, oh, no, it's word-centered. Okay, that's good. And the sacrament of the word are very good things. But when I look at the Bible, I see fellowship-centered churches. I don't know. Is that about right? Yeah. They broke bread, you know, it was a fellowship issue. So now what would that look like? You know, yeah, it's New Testament, you know. It's interesting. Everybody wants to be like the New Testament church, but the New Testament church didn't have the New Testament, you know. So, you know, maybe we need to learn how to preach from the Old Testament a little bit. You know, now what's the value of the Old Testament? Well, I used to have trouble with the Old Testament. One time I actually prayed. I said, Lord, I don't like reading the Old Testament because there's a whole lot of cutting and shooting and ducking and dodging and peeping and hiding and all kind of crazy stuff going on there. You know, I said, how can you put up with that mess? And it was almost, I didn't hear the audible voice, but it was certainly very clear. The question to me was, look around you and what do you see? I said, well, let's see, there's cutting and shooting and ducking. And then it just dawned on me, oh, okay, all right, I see the point here. God is showing us in the Old Testament how he can work in a mess, how he can work in the hood, you know. I mean, you know, it's the hood, you know. So if God can do that, then why can't we, you know? I don't know. It just seems to me that we spend a lot of our time. I mean, I know from my tradition, the African-American tradition has produced some tremendous preachers. I mean, you know, it's one of the great, great strengths, you know. But, of course, there are those who see the tradition as an end in itself. And so then the preaching then begins to degenerate into entertainment, you know. And then see who can out-entertain who, you know, that kind of thing. Well, but we all have those quirks, don't we? I mean, you know, you got these mega churches, who's the biggest, you know, who's the baddest, who's got the most TV time and all that kind of stuff. And I just think that the more we do, the more we are projecting a very negative image. And again, we need to clean up some toxic waste, you know. So I think the church in a lot of ways, you know, the American church, period. I think we are probably squandering 90 to 95% of the resources of the kingdom on foolishness. All right, and that goes across the board. That's my suspicion. So, you know, we need to start somewhere. And I think as I said, as we look at this, the African American church history, I hope that you picked up some new tools, some new hermeneutical tools for cultural analysis as well as biblical analysis. You know what I'm saying? I hope you picked that up, you know. And that's the value of studying the history of church and other cultures.
Question about, you said that the live route for theology to take are things along the lines of theologies of empowerment and theology of dysfunction.
Issues of empowerment, issues of dysfunction. So right. we need to theologically address those issues. Yeah, we don't want a theology of dysfunctionality now. Okay. Okay.
Is developing a theology around suffering a less naive route, do you think, to take?
A theology of suffering. Well, I would say that. I would say that it is not as I don't think it's as appropriate today as it would have been 100 years ago. Okay, let's put it that way. Excuse me, but we can learn a lot from the theology of suffering, and that's one of those things that that can make a contribution, because the theology of suffering can be a very powerful thing, you know. So, but it's
less of a cultural core issue type.
That's right, today, right, because, right. But yet and still, we are still, large segments of the African American church are still operating on that theology, the theology of suffering. And so it doesn't click with the young folks. You know, they're saying, well, what is this? You know, yes, okay, I'll wait, we'll wait.